what we saw in Bolotnaya.
Navalny is not exactly an outsider.
And Pussy Riot, because Nadia Talokonikova.
Сочи стартует церемония
Сочи. Михаил Ходорковский освобожден.
If Euromaidan sort of has some
Crimea
clear,
is not possible like without Sochi.
The whole idea of these little green men.
Bolotnaya, Navalny, and Pussy Riot. Sochi, Ходорковский, and the Euromaidan. Crimea, the Donbass, and little green men. Information war, cyber attacks, hybrid war, Boris Nemtsov, and the Panama Papers. 5 years ago this week, the Power Vertical podcast kicked off as a regular program, and these are just a handful of the things we discussed. It's been a wild half decade, and today we put the old band back together for an anniversary show, so let's have a look back and a look ahead. Hello from our broadcast headquarters in Prague, and welcome to the Power Vertical podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFURL. Joining me here in the studio is co-host Mark Galliotti, a senior policy fellow at the Institute of International Relations in Prague, a visiting fellow at the European Council on Foreign Relations, and author of the blog In Moscow Shadows. Welcome, Mark.
Well, happy fifth birthday, Brian. Well,
thank you. Thank you. I like being five. And joining me on the Skype line from the Latvian town of Ventspils, where he is hanging out for some reason, is my original co-host, Kirill Kobrin, editor of the Moscow-based history and sociology magazine NZ, and author of a recently published series for Open Democracy on the end of the post-Soviet period. Welcome back, Kirill.
Happy to join the ranks again.
Yeah, happy to have you in the ranks again. And also joining us via Skype from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, is one of the Power Vertical podcast's very first guests, Sean Guillory of the University of Pittsburgh's Center for Russian and Eastern European Studies, author of Sean's Russia blog, and host of the SRB podcast. Welcome back, Sean.
Happy anniversary.
Thank you. Thank you. So 5 years ago, in the wake of the castling and the dying days of the tandem, on the eve of Vladimir Putin's return to the Kremlin, in the aftermath of the disputed State Duma elections that momentarily rejuvenated the Russian opposition and launched the protest movement, the Power Vertical podcast was born. Truth told, the very first podcast was earlier in March 2011, but at that point it was just an experiment, an occasional thing. It was with the Bolotnaya protests and the dramatic events at the end of 2011 that it became a regular program. And to say the least, it was a very different world than the one we're living in now, Kirill, when you and I were in the studio that doing that first podcast. Let's start with Mark, since he's here in the studio with me now. What surprised you most about the last 5 years, how it's all played out?
I think I would say it's the speed and the comprehensiveness with which we saw the death of Putin the pragmatist. I mean, again, if we look back to the Putin who was coming into power post-castling, yes, I mean, he'd clearly made a blunder born of arrogance in just simply this arranged marriage, shall we say. But on the other hand, the Putin that we were expecting was a Putin who talked tough on nationalism, but in practice, even though he clearly had sort of fallen out of, well, he was never in love, but sort of fallen out of tolerance with NATO and the West, nonetheless, he had a much, much more solid grasp of, if I can put it in these ways, reality. And yet now,
it.
I mean, we have seen this guy who's gone through this extraordinary transformation to clearly becoming an ideological president, a president who is also very much concerned with his kind of grand historical narrative rather than the sort of the nuts and bolts of trying to bring Russia up. And in the process is burning through so much of the country's political, economic, foreign policy resources and reserves.
Human capital.
Yeah, human capital of every kind. And I think, so on one level, you know, say he looks as if he's strong. But it's a little bit like having a next-door neighbour who comes with a new car or a new gimmick every week, and yet you don't see his credit card bills. I think this is the thing. I think the extent to which actually a Putin who at one point did seem to have at least some eye to the practical future is now burning everything for a historical narrative future.
What about you, Kirill? You're the historian. What surprised you about the last 5 years? If you think back to when we first did this podcast,
just almost everything. You know, everything changed from that time. You know, in Russia and in the outer world also. First of all, I agree with Mark. Yeah, Putin is becoming and became actually an ideological president, but it's very interesting without any ideology, really.
Did this surprise you, Kirill?
You know, common sense says that if you are ideological president, you must have, a sort of ideology. But what does Putin really have? He has a sort of a pseudo-ideological approach, but not an ideology, which is absolutely different. His approach is ideological because it's based on, sort of fake Medinsky-style history, which have been constructed quite successfully for the last 5 years. It's another one interesting process. You know, what and how the regime played and still playing with history, with historical memory, and so on. It's second point. And the third point is a dramatic change in in outer world, in the scenery, the environment of what's going on in Russia. You know, 5 years ago, we had a quite reasonable West, whom Russian liberals and, Russian opposition and just, ordinary Russian, rationally thinking people could depend on. Mm-hmm. But now it's not so. Now we have what do we have? So I am not going to explain.
I don't think we need to go into the gory details there.
Yes, but it's undermined the very idea of a sort of democracy as a sort of bright example which they need to follow. And this is a disaster in some sense for Russian public opinion. Mm.
Sean, what surprised you?
A couple of things. I mean, I think the protests, what they symbolize in retrospect is the need, the loss on the one hand of a consensus for the regime as a whole. And it's interesting because I think it's worth thinking about the protests in 2011, 2012 as part of this global trend that had been going on, I think, since the mid-2000s with the colored revolutions and the Arab Spring and Occupy movements. So Russia, I think, was part of this crisis of representation that's kind of sweeping throughout the world and continues now in many respects. But what's interesting is it was a loss of consensus because the first two terms of Putin's rule was based on this developing this kind of modern middle class, right? The Russian middle class, I think, came out of this to a certain extent.
What Pavlovsky used to call the Putin majority.
The Putin majority or Putin's children or whatever you want to call it. And then 2009 hits, right? I think that the economic crash, which usually isn't put in this in the context of the 2011 protests, is a factor because it really hit started whittling this new middle class to some extent. And with the protests, Putin lost this consensus. But what's interesting is that the first two terms of Putin was built on this consensus. And then with the protests, he moves to this more populist or, embracing the Russian silent majority. And that consensus is quite tenuous because he's had to reproduce it over and over again. He had to reproduce it with Crimea. He's had to reproduce it with this move to traditional values or this attempt to this ideological president, right, to represent some sort of Russian-ness, however broadly defined, mostly in a cultural sense, but also in Russian-ness in a great power sense, right? The restoration of Russia as a great power, confrontation with the West, involvement in global affairs, etc. And the question I have now is that how is he going to maintain that consensus? Because he doesn't, unlike the first two terms where that consensus was built on throwing money at and developing the middle class and having a lot of oil money to spend, that money isn't there now.
Mm. It's kind of like Mark's neighbor with a new gadget every week, and we're not seeing his credit card bill.
In a way, yeah. So I think that this has it's going to exhaust itself unless some new consensus is going to be reformed. Mm. And the question is, how is that going to happen?
Mm. I'll tell you what surprised me is the degree of resilience that Putin's had. I had thought he was on the ropes so many times in the last 5 years that you can almost parody me for it. You can also probably make a mashup of me saying he's been on the ropes over the years. I thought he was on the ropes at the end of 2011. I thought he was on the ropes with the rise of Navalny. I thought he was on the ropes when the Euromaidan happened and the example that was going to set in Russia. And again and again and again and again, he's come back like Freddy Krueger. And it's just really that this is the thing that surprised me to the point where I'm almost getting to the point where I'm not going to say he's on the ropes again. Mark, another related question, and that is that if you look at this past like year like a story, what was the main story arc? If this were a movie, what would the trailer say? If you look at the last 2011 to 2016, what would the trailer of this movie say? What's the story arc?
Well, let me get back to the movie. Let me just take okay. one sort of narrow piece. I mean, this notion of Putin on the ropes. See, I'm not quite sure if I fully agree with Sean's point about this kind of having to constantly create a consensus. I think that's a bit over instrumental. I'm not sure if Putin is so connected or indeed interested in what the overwhelming majority think, except insofar as, well, in part it's his vanity. Because we really need to listen to Lenin on these, as in all matters. And Lenin said that basically, you know, a revolution succeeds when the regime demonstrates a critical absence of will. I mean, basically, and then this thing I think is Lenin is right, is essentially the regimes are not toppled, they collapse. And the revolutionary force is just there to either take advantage of that or give it that last little push. Now, one thing we have seen this regime has not lacked for is will. It has the capacity to deploy violence on a piecemeal as well as wholesale basis. But more to the point, it just seeks to kind of demonstrate its indomitability so people don't even try and do anything about it. And so in some ways, this is actually the strength of Putin's turning into a caricature of himself, is that so long as it is a believable caricature.
you know, and it's pushing the limits of that.
Yeah, but nonetheless, people think this is not a guy you mess with. He's got his National Guard and everything else. So actually, in some ways, yeah, it's an element of brittleness. If at some point something happens to make it sort of be shown to be a facade, but at the moment it looks strong. But movies-wise, I mean, I'm not honestly sure which genre of movie this would be. I mean, I imagine Putin thinks of it as sort of halfway between the Bourne franchise and sort of one of these aggrandizing pseudo-histories like the new Panfilov film. With an increasing sort of amount of control, it feels a little bit more like a high-tech Lives of Others. But to be honest, I suspect it's actually really going back to the old genre of sort of Moscow doesn't believe in tears kind of kitchen sink classics. But what I do think is this is film two in a trilogy.
Uh-huh.
And actually it sort of fits if you think of The Empire Strikes Back or The Two Towers. But, I mean, it's that point in the film, in the
well, I think it's been Return of the King, if you want to go there.
Well,
and God forbid I use a Lord of the Rings reference.
Well, but this is it. But you should read it though to find out who the king is. But the thing is that this is the point in the trilogy arc where in a way the bad guys have to look at their toughest and at their most successful, because it will justify the victory of the goodies and it'll make it much more dramatically appealing when it happens at the end. The second film is precisely to have all the sort of the gathering storm elements. If it's in Western terms, it's when the hero in the white hat has to get a kicking. If it's in espionage terms, it's where the hero's girlfriend has to be gunned down to justify all the whoop-ass that is unleashed at the end. Now, so in that respect, I mean, I think we're in this funny position where precisely at present the bad guys seem to be winning. They have, you know, they have the Death Star. They have all these various other sorts of things, and that the heroes are on the run. But I think we need to be aware that there is a wider trilogy arc in the making.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Kirill, this is right up your alley. I'm almost scared to ask you this question. But what is what's the story arc of the last 5 years, 2011, 2016? What's the movie trailer say?
Well, it switched from, you know, the movie thing to the novel.
All right, go with a novel, sure.
I was speaking to a writer, sort of writer.
You are in a writer's colony in Latvia right now, as I understand, so I guess that makes sense.
So I think it looks like a sort of a Latin American novel about dictator. Like The Autumn of the Patriarch by Marquez or something like this, psychologically, you know. If you just look at Putin in the last 5 years, he looks actually very, you know, bored and tired and not so, you know, aggressive as he was, and so on. He's, of course, he in some sense he's tired of this power and so on, but he's in a sort of mousetrap because he cannot lose the power and so on. So it's a very well-known psychological story of 20th century, well-known for those who lived in Argentina, in Brazil, in Chile, in and so on, and even in Central and Eastern Europe. I mean, several countries between the wars, like Latvia, Poland, and so on. On the other hand, I think that it's very important to have in mind that the example of Putin, who is, you know, you're told that you're telling the world that Putin is, you know, on the brink of fall, you know, several dozens times in 5 years and so on. So it's not a mistake, it's not a delusion, because the point of view from what from which you told these words and so on, the point of view of common sense, and especially usually when we speak about politics and political leaders and so on, we have in mind that there is such thing as national interest. Mm-hmm. That this particular leader, he is following sort of national interest. He's very interested or has some interest in, you know, in his own country. And that was a delusion. From the point of view that Russia must be, you know, rich, you know, powerful or respected in all over the world and so on, he failed every time.
I think he might have won on the respected part. Or at least, or I think he might have won on the respected part, or at least the feared part.
Yes, there is a difference between being feared and being respected, and so on. But,
I'm not sure there is in his mind, but
I was speaking about the change, dramatic change of the environment, and that's very important. But from the point of view of the, you know, national interest of such country as Russian Federation, he failed every time. And if he would be, you know, a responsible leader and so on, he was on the brink, you know, several times or several, you know, dozen times and so on. But if we think about him as a sort of just a dictator, just ordinary dictator, like, you know, a lot of examples in the 20th century, that is true. And I think the one of the main things, the main, you know, truth that had been revealed for last 5 years, that he is not, you know, sort of normal or semi-normal political leader. He's just a dictator, like Perón, like, you know, and so on.
Sean, what do you think? What's the arc?
I think the arc is like one of those hit drama shows that runs for several years and loses its energy, and people still, it still gets produced and people still watch it, but nobody knows why. And it, all it takes is for someone to say, okay, the show is over, let's pull the plug, let's have a finale and move on, either do a spin-off with some of the characters or reinvent the show altogether. And, you know, I think, and I wonder, not to push things ahead to our second half, I mean, the big question is, you know, how's this show going to end and who's going to end it? Because just by normal human lifespan, it can't go on forever.
No,
right,
right.
But the other thing I wanted to point out is that, and this is interesting in our discussion so far, is that, you know, the protesters themselves haven't been part of our discussion
for a long time,
and for a long time. And it's interesting because how the regime crushed them is quite. You know, one has to say that the way that the system dealt with opposition shows its very strength and will, as Marx said, but it also shows a fundamental weakness in the opposition, in that I don't know if there have been, they've learned the lessons of the protests, and what happened after to move forward. Because as things stand now, if, you know, the regime, say, if Putin is on the ropes, as you've said repeatedly over the years, and the regime collapsed tomorrow, there's nothing really to fill the vacuum that exists. It would have to be reconfigured at that moment.
What do you think the lessons of the protest were?
The lessons for me is that they, for whatever reason, could not come up with a program that went beyond the political and political rights. It could, it did not communicate to the average Russian out there somewhere, even within Moscow, but also out there in the country, who deals with daily injustices, daily humiliations. I think the rhetoric of humiliation of the time could have been communicated if it was reconfigured in a more of a, say, social economic sense and less, and not just a political sense.
Go ahead.
Because it's shown that in terms of political rights, most Russians don't see that as a mobilizing factor. They may care about it, but it's not a mobilizing factor.
Don't you think Navalny was trying to do that with the anti-corruption thing, showing how corruption took away money that could have been spent on a lot of things making Russians' lives better?
Yeah, but that's a program of negation.
Mm-hmm.
That's not a positive program. You know, it's like, okay, you know, if you're telling a Russian who lives in Perm or something that the system is corrupt, they shrug their shoulders and says, "Yeah, sure." Right. I mean, I deal with it just going to get my driver's license. What about, you know, these guys are stealing, okay, but on my daily level with my local administration, my daily life, I deal with corruption every day. Okay, so what?
So this is what's one of next? The problems with calling them the opposition, because again, it implies this kind of binary that there is the state and the opposition. I mean, firstly, they were just an opposition, and precisely they were an opposition. They weren't an alternative. But I mean, nowadays, the reason we don't talk about the protesters is because there are no protesters. I mean, the opposition now is precisely the tram driver in Perm who strikes tomorrow.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Or indeed the disgruntled oligarch who's talking to his people saying, "We don't dare move now, but I'm really unhappy with the way things are going," and everything in between. There is a lot of opposition, but there is no alternative.
Mm-hmm. Mark, what do you think the lessons were from the Bolotnaya protest that kicked all this off and the regime's response to it?
Well, ruthless regimes always win, unfortunately. If you have the security forces united, it's the Tiananmen Square lesson, unfortunately. And again, this simply shows my own moral bankruptcy. But essentially, whenever you actually have a regime whose security forces are essentially united and willing to follow orders, and a regime which is willing to, if need be, give those orders. I mean, they didn't have to obviously do the worst things with Bolotnaya. You know, they didn't have to sort of shoot on crowds or whatever. But to be perfectly honest, there is at least a fairly reasonable basis to assume that they could have found people who would have been willing to do that if need be. In a way that, for example, didn't happen in 1991, because people in part just didn't think that momentum and history was on the side of the coup plotters then. No, I think, unfortunately, fairly unified, fairly ruthless regimes will win.
Mm.
And that's why the crucial thing is precisely to open fault lines within these regimes before you go to the streets.
Well, this is the thing, and if you rewind back to those days of the protests, I was always talking about this phenomenon of when Alexei meets Alexei, when Navalny and Kudrin metaphorically, mm-hmm. if not literally, get together, when the street matches up with any opposition within the elite, although that apparently just didn't happen.
Right. It didn't happen, but also, you might say, whether Kudrin was the guy. I mean, if you look at Yeltsin,
and I wasn't speaking specifically of Kudrin, but
no, but that's again, it's very much, it's a certain way of looking at opposition. Whereas actually, if you look at how Yeltsin arranged things, there you had the phone lines going hot as his people were calling up KGB officers in 1991.
Mm-hmm.
Not hello, liberal neocon banker. What, you know, would you like to join us? But hello, vicious, pragmatic, unprincipled, and yet distinctly useful secret policeman.
Right.
Would you like to join us, or at least refrain from, you know, doing anything?
He had Alexander Korshakov to smooth that.
Yeah,
for
I mean,
him as
very,
well.
Very rarely would I ever say thank God for Alexander Korshakov. But in that respect, at least, it's true.
Kirill, go.
Just several, speaking about the lessons of Bolotnaya and so on. Yeah, first is, I was on Bolotnaya in February 2012, and that was the last time I've seen together communists, nationalists, Kudrin, Nadia Talakonnikova.
Saying yourself, Jack.
Yes, 2 days before her arrest and so on. And that's the first lesson. They had one enemy. They united. They united their ranks because they were unhappy with the one particular person, and this person was Putin. So opposition could be against in Russia. It's very sad, but now opposition in Russia could be just against particular person, particular figure, but not against particular politics or way of doing policy and so on. Secondly, opposition couldn't propose or offer a sort of new agenda for the society, for Russian society, and still doesn't. And cannot offer any sort of agenda. I absolutely agree with Sean. Of course, there is no such thing as, opposition program for, industry or for trade or for, social justice or social rights and so on. So nothing, absolutely nothing. And the third lesson is that, protests and opposition, as it was Moscow-centered, it's still. Mm-hmm. There's nothing like this, even in St. Petersburg. I'm not speaking about Russian province and so on. In this case, Mark is absolutely right. If you have a ruthless security service and united and so on, and just ready to follow your orders and so on, if you're a dictator, you're a regime and so on, you'll win. But if you have an opposition in the all provincial towns and cities and villages and so on, no any, the best in the world security services could suppress this thing. So that is another lesson, and which is very important.
Now, I would add, though, Kirill, that the labor protests and the social protests are taking place not in Moscow and St. Petersburg, but in the provinces. That's what we're seeing.
First of all, there are just few of them. And secondly, they don't have political language for their social problems. And that is the most important thing, because so-called political, oppositional political journalists and so on, they're speaking on their, bird language about, human rights and so on, but they cannot invent a new political language for social injustice and so on. Russia is the most social, unjust country in Europe. And there is no such terms like, social injustice in modern Russian political language. And that is the problem.
Yeah, I completely agree with Kirill on this. Yeah, there are labor protests, but they're all very wildcat. They're very localized. They tend to be either repressed or in a combination of coercion and co-optation. They get money thrown at them. They rarely link up. There's only been a very few examples of linking up. They rarely reach enough media attention to be noticed by, people who are even interested in politics in general. But I think this is this. There's no – the political language of how to frame this is completely absent.
Mm-hmm. Now, I wanted to, we talked a lot in the last 5 years at some point, not lately, but a lot about Navalny. And if you go back to, summer of 2013, I saw this person as somebody who looked like somebody who was about to take power. And I think some of you actually agreed with me on this at the time. If you think back to when he was imprisoned and those riots on the streets of Moscow, you think to that crowd that greeted him at the train station upon his return from prison. You think of the Moscow mayor campaign and you start to think this is somebody that is building a constituency. Why did Navalny fail, or has he failed? This is something we can get into in the second half a little bit. Mark, what do you think?
Well, thank you for putting me on point with this question.
I would say that
he did fail. In the sense of, if his aim was to actually sort of bring about a kind of specific change there and then, I'm sure history will treat him a different way. The thing is that he has extraordinary strengths and so forth, and I still love watching his YouTube videos, which are kind of must watches,
which are brilliant. Yeah.
On little incidences of corruption, but that's the whole point. That is sort of, as much as anything else, tickling a Western audience rather than reaching out. This is, in some ways,
they're in Russian.
Yeah, but the point is that, I don't on the whole think that actually its main readership or viewership is across the province. This was Navalny's thing. On the one hand, he was brilliant at understanding the capacities of new media and so forth. But that's where he stuck. He never really got into the point or was able, to a large extent it's because one person can't do this, but actually to institutionalise that, to create political structures that were going to go beyond his political comfort zone.
And he was able to put people on the streets.
He was able to put people on the streets in Moscow.
Mm.
Which is a unique bubble of a city and a particular sort of person. I mean, I don't necessarily believe that there are large numbers of, you know, impoverished people from the outer dormitory suburbs. I remember going to one of the, you know, just was walking past by chance, one of the sort of protests outside the police station in Zamoskvoreche, the court in Zamoskvoreche, where they were doing sort of the lesser Bolotnaya protesters. And you're looking around, and basically it was an exceedingly middle class, highly educated sort of group of people there, which is fine. I mean, it's not in any way a critique of them. It's the whole point is Navalny needed to go beyond that base if he was actually to require any kind of political moment.
Mm-hmm.
And that he was both structurally, because of the sort of the massive limitations of the opposition movement as a whole at that time, which really, you know, managed to rip itself apart with extraordinary capacity and frequency. But also, as I said, I think ultimately it was that kind of the grubby, tedious end of politics that Navalny never really seemed to be going for.
Sean Kirill, would you agree with that?
Well, I would just also add that, I mean, he was effectively neutralized.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he played his role quite well in the sense of, you know, on the one hand, he a central figure leading opposition forces and then playing the role of somewhat safety valve in the Moscow elections. And then he was repressed and sidelined and marginalized. And perhaps despite this neutralization, he could have gotten around that. But as Mark said, there was no shift in message or even organization to circumvent that marginalization, and he is where he's at.
Mm-hmm. Kirill, you agree?
Yes, but partly. First of all, I think this regime, you know, terribly needs such figure as Navalny. He plays a role of, you know, Tabasco sauce and Bloody Mary cocktail. secondly, I'm not sure that opposition needs now a political party. We're living in the times of populism. Political parties, they're just losing everything. You know, in every country you see, you know, just from Great Britain to United States and so on. It's a new sort of political reality, and maybe, you know, sort of populist movement, you know, being leaded by just one figure like Navalny could be more effective than political party. Thirdly, for last 5 years, the very connotation of the words people on the streets changed dramatically from positive to negative.
Mm-hmm.
So we, all of us, we are just a bit afraid of people on the streets now. And while we are, you know, speaking about you know, it would be great if people will come to the streets, you know, protesting against Putin regime and so on. Who knows what's on their mind of these people and so on. So it's just absolutely negative thing now, and I think that the story of Navalny is not finished, and we'll see him.
No, this is something. This is something I do want to return to in the second half when we talk about the future. Right now, I want to move to another opposition figure whose name also happens to begin with N, and that, of course, is Boris Yefimovich Nemtsov. His assassination, a watershed, something that put a chill into the opposition. Mark, what do you think?
I don't think it was a watershed. I mean, as we sort of spoke at the time, it was obviously both a tragedy and a brutal crime, which obviously hasn't also been properly investigated and carried through. But I think by that point, again, Nemtsov was not a meaningful opposition figure.
But Nemtsov, the symbol afterwards.
But even then, but you might say it would have been, I think, if there had been real evidence that this was something that the Kremlin was behind, and the Kremlin was smirking and suggesting, and you know, who's next? But actually, there was massive dismay within the establishment structures, and to an extent, Kadyrov, you know, for a while, his future did seem to be on a knife edge. Even though, when it came down to it, the Kremlin didn't have the passion for what it feared was going to be a third Chechen war if it toppled him.
But I think the effect of that. I mean, I agree with you to a point. But the fact that you have this loose cannon Kadyrov that might go whacking anybody who he thinks the Kremlin doesn't like and get away with it, and not only get away with it, but get so many medals he has to grow a second chest, has to put a chilling effect into opponents of the regime. Whether or not that was the Kremlin's intent, I think it was the result. And I think the Kremlin was very aware that that was the result. And that may be one of the reasons Kadyrov did get away with beyond the fears of a third Chechen war.
Well, no? Except, I suppose I would say, well, okay, where's your data? There's no point because we're all just talking. I mean, where's any of our data? No, but I mean, I think come down to, I mean, I can't, I mean, maybe I'm just overlooking something. I can't look at something and think, ah, yes, well, this is where an opposition figure, and I didn't even know who we'd think of as opposition figures either. You know, this is an opposition figure who clearly changed or backed down or got more quiet or whatever. I think the trouble is, the reason why the Nemtsov thing was obviously sort of significant, but in some ways it actually fit the assumptions of the narrative. I mean, I think in a way, it's not as if people up to that point had thought, no, this is a regime which has sort of clear red lines. I think for a lot of people, they had assumed this is a regime which would have people directly or indirectly whacked. And if that's what they thought...
People, but not former deputy prime ministers. There was kind of this unwritten understanding, if I could believe what I read in the Russian press.
But this was unwritten within the Vlasti. I mean, within the powerful people, absolutely. And I think, you know, where it dismayed people was not what we would think of as the opposition. I think it's actually...
It dismayed
people,
the elite.
Exactly. It's people within the elite who felt that there was a certain... there were certain parameters. You could be kind of... There was still just about room for a bit of... I hesitate to call it loyal opposition, but pluralism within the system. And I think for people who are, as it were, more on the outer bounds of that, yeah, this absolutely was scary. But these are not what we would think of as opposition. Mm-hmm. So I think what it actually just simply did was precisely clamp down on genuine discussion within the elite. Mm-hmm. And I think that's actually also proven to be quite disastrous for the decision-making processes within the government, because precisely there's fewer and fewer people who are willing to bring up counter to what seems to be the line coming down from mm-hmm. the Kremlin.
Sean, what do you think?
I think the symbolism of his assassination went both ways. I think it went to the elite, and it also went to the, you know, opposition forces broadly defined, because Nemtsov was one of these people who straddled that line. And I think that if... You know, the protests, the wave of protests that occurred had already died down. Bolotnaya pretty much sealed the deal on that.
Yeah.
But I think what the Nemtsov assassination did is it eliminated the possibility of opposition because it chilled out. I mean, not only... I mean, if you go back to this idea you have of Alexei meeting Alexei, that was... That now is... broken even further because it shows even one of our former own or on the margins of the elite or bridges the gap between these two groups has been taken out. I think the symbolism of it creates a chilling effect throughout political society in general.
Mm-hmm. Kirill, he was from your hometown of Nizhny Novgorod.
Yes, I was quite, you know, had and still have a quite warm feeling toward Boris. But I think that was a watershed, but not for political process in Russia, but of political system of Russia. After this killing, I decided, you know, I told to myself that there is no such thing as Russian Federation no more. That's very important. There are several territories or regions in Russian Federation which are not a part of this country, of this legal system, of this security service system and whatnot and so on, enforcement and any. So Chechnya is the extension of this country.
And Chechnya came to Moscow on that day.
That is the watershed. And that shows how dangerous is the process, this process is, first of all. I am not speaking about dangerous for the leaders of opposition. I'm speaking dangerous for the regime itself. Secondly, in some sense, this murder was quite, you know, good thing for a future relationships or dealings with Kadyrov for Putin and his circle. You know, this murder I'm not speaking who did it or, you know, who was behind it.
I think there's a general consensus about who was behind it.
Okay. about this. But this event just filled another, you know, space in inside or in Kadyrov's political karma. You know, and it's a very useful thing because sometime in the future, someone will definitely remind him and the society about this and this and this and that event.
Mm-hmm.
And this is a very effective tool to use in future again, as they think in the Kremlin and so on. And that's why they give this, you know, relatively free hand to Kadyrov now, because they think they would use all this stuff sometime in the future.
When he's expendable, yeah. When he's no longer useful. No, Kirill, I completely agree with you, and I actually wrote a piece about this around the time called The Untouchables and the Expendables, comparing Kadyrov with Vladimir Kumarin, who was the leader of the Tomboskaya Grupirovka in St. Petersburg, who got away with murder literally many, 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 many times. And then when he was no longer useful, all those skeletons from his closet were brought up, and now he's locked away. And when Kadyrov is no longer useful, now God knows when that's going to be. But yeah, I think you're right. These skeletons from his closet will all come up again. We're more than 30 minutes in, and we haven't talked about foreign affairs yet, and we probably, given everything that's going on, we probably should hit that note before we move into the second half. We've gone from basically a Russia that looked like it was on the ropes to a West that looks like it's on the ropes right now. Kirill, you alluded to this earlier in the program, the change in the international environment. Putin looks positively triumphant, not just at home right now, but abroad as well. And you can talk about Syria. You can talk about the political war he's very successfully been waging on the West. You can talk about the results of elections in various Western countries and the expected results of elections in other Western countries. You can look at it any way you want, and he appears to be winning. Mark, you use this analogy of the neighbor with the fancy car every week, but you never see his credit card bill. Does this analogy also apply to foreign affairs, or is Putin truly winning right now?
I don't think Putin's truly winning right now. Firstly, I mean, most of the things that you've described actually really have very little, I think, to do with Putin. He may well be the beneficiary, particularly of the current sort of crisis and malaise in the West. He's certainly not its architect.
But he successfully fed it and successfully exploited it.
Well,
he saw the opportunity.
We assume that he's had a role. I suspect it's very, very small in actually leading to this. I mean, we're giving him far, far more credit. And in the process, actually, we empower him when we elevate him to this status as the grand master who is sort of playing this geopolitical game across, you know, the whole sort of northern hemisphere. You know, we actually give him power that we really should not. No, I think on the whole, the things he has benefited from have nothing to do with Putin, nothing to do with Russia. Yes, RT will help here and some money will help there. He'll, of course, try and nudge it. And where there are fine, fine distinctions between election results and so forth, then yes, a percentage point here and a percentage point there
Took in Brexit.
Though that said, I mean, again,
if he swung at a percentage point, he swung it.
But to be perfectly honest, again, I mean, in terms of obviously it's very early for there to be, you know, real studies, but certainly kind of preliminary stuff doesn't really suggest that there's been much of that actually the Russian impact had much. So I think, first of all, let's just distinguish between what Putin is the beneficiary of rather than what he's actually causing. Secondly, I mean, actually, so many of these things he's doing, if you look at the long term price tag, it's ruinous. I mean, Syria. Successful in the short term, absolutely no question. I mean, he deployed his forces, a very small force, to basically stop the West, or above all, the America, from trying to isolate Russia geopolitically, and more or less say, no, you do not get to do that. You have to talk to us, you have to treat us as a great power, and especially in the Middle East. And there he was successful.
He was successful in propping up Bashar al-Assad. And
yeah, though I think
Aleppo's pretty much fallen.
But at the same time, though, I mean, he missed that. He had that opportunity to then basically carry out his first thing, stop the initial swing of momentum against the Assad regime, and then pull out. And, you know, he talked about pulling out, but then it turned out it was actually just going to be a kind of a reconfiguration. I suspect, actually, he changed his mind. And now he's stuck. He's got an increasing number of ground troops, some of whom, you know, many of whom are masquerading as mercenaries, but they're Russian troops. He's now stuck supporting a regime which, even, you know, even if it completely trashes Aleppo, it's not going to imminently be in charge and win the war. This is going to be a long, grinding, miserable civil war that still could have many reversals in the process. He's got Crimea, fine. Obviously, and a whole load of sanctions to go with it. The Donbass he's stuck in. I mean, the Donbass is the unacknowledged oblast that is basically having to be maintained with federal subsidies, to say nothing of all the geopolitical cost and the extent to which it gives the Poroshenko regime the perfect alibi for all the things it's not doing. I mean, I think, and this current sort of political war with the West, yeah, at the moment, it definitely is scaring a lot of people, and it might be sort of nudging some results, and it's clearly helping degrade the European Union in particular.
It could potentially end sanctions. It could potentially get him the free hand he wants in the former Soviet space.
Well, to a large extent, I mean, he's probably got it thanks to Trump. But the thing is, at the same time, though, I mean, these all have huge political costs. I mean, there is now no question in the parts of many sort of security apparatuses that Russia is a threat. And even if we see populist regimes coming, they're not going to change that underlying perspective. You know, a lot of these regimes that say nice things about Trump or, sorry, about Putin or Russia or whatever, they're not quislings. They are unhappy with a certain line. They maybe want sanctions lifted or just simply think that there's some kind of economic opportunity there or similar. But, you know, they're not going to roll over. And the point is, almost invariably, I imagine that actually the Russia's relationship with these governments will very quickly sour.
Over the long term. And I agree with you. What he's doing is ruinous in the long term. But as John Maynard Keynes said, in the long term, we're all dead. And you can do a lot of damage in the short term.
But this is it. But damn it. In some ways, this is exactly the counterpart of the whole debate about opposition versus alternative. Well, likewise, actually, Russia is providing, shall I say, opposition to an order. He's doing damage. But let's not pretend in any way that he's creating some kind of substitute of some kind of global structure which will actually be advantageous to Russia. Actually, a 19th century style world, red in geopolitical tooth and claw, would be very, very dangerous for what is, after all, a declining, weakened and friendless Russia.
I certainly hope you're right. Sean Kirill, anything to add on this foreign affairs before we move on?
Yeah, I mostly agree with Mark, particularly on this pumping up the Putin threat and feeding into the myth of his supervillainy. Because the truth of the matter is, and I go back to where I started, there has been a crisis of representation throughout the Western world in the last, you know, several years since 2008, mostly, but even before that to a large extent. And that crisis of representation is continuing. Now, the interesting aspect of it is that the solution, or at least proposed solutions to this crisis, are coming from the populist right. And I think this is though, of course, connected to Russia, and Russia is certainly doing its best to meddle things. I think for most of these populations in Europe and the United States, Russia exists on another planet. It doesn't communicate to their daily lives in any particular way, but the forces of populism are speaking to them, and they're providing a solution to this crisis. Now, whether that crisis will be resolved is a different issue. I think that Russia has more stepped into a vacuum, particularly in the Middle East, you know, basically came in upon the destruction mostly caused by Western governments, and taking advantage of a situation that was created for them rather than one that they're pushing and shaping themselves. Mm.
I would agree with you that Russia's in a different planet for most Americans. For most Europeans, they're very, very much on the same planet, and for many, very uncomfortably close. Last thoughts, Kirill?
I agree that Russia's power and Putin's power is very, you know, overrated in modern world. What's happening now? I agree with Sean. It's just a reaction on the sort of crisis of neoliberal ideology or liberal ideology in modern world and so on, and people usually mix it with or, you know, take it for Russia influence and so on. It's not Russia influence. It's just objectively a crisis of some political, ideological, and even philosophical values. And that's all. Because post-Soviet, post-Cold War agenda is all over. We don't know what sort of new agenda we will have or will, you know, construct in several years. And that's why in this sort of empty place is filled by, you know, fears of Russia, Putin, and so on. Secondly, if in his international politics, Putin is successful, he is successful in making dead ends. Mm-hmm. Everywhere. Everywhere where they just trying to use power or, you know, hybrid war or something like this, from Crimea to Donbass to Syria and so on, it's just a series of dead ends. They took Crimea, but they don't know what to do with Crimean population and so on. They took Donbass, but they don't know what to do with Donbass. They just playing some sort of role, a very dangerous role in Syrian conflict. But so what's next for Syria? What's next? What's the outcome of this war? You know, Assad back to the power and the whole Syrian government, you know, running by Assad. So it's ridiculous, absolutely. So in some sense, it's very ironic, but in some sense, Putin is playing Alexei Navalny's role in international relations. He is just trying to use other mistakes. He criticizing weak points, and he's very successful in this. That's why RT propaganda is very successful, because if you criticizing others, weak points and so on, you're always successful. But you cannot offer something positive. Mm-hmm. And of course, in some perspective, all this thing would be over. Definitely will be over.
Well, you set us up nicely for the second half, and we're going to look at the future in a few moments. We will continue our discussion and discuss what the past 5 years tell us about what the next 5 years may bring. I'd like to remind you, you're listening to the Power Vertical Podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFERL. Joining me here in the studio is co-host Mark Galliotti, a senior policy fellow at the Institute of International Relations in Prague, a visiting fellow at the European Council on Foreign Relations and author of the blog In Moscow Shadows. And joining us on the Skype line from the Latvian town of Ventspils is my original co-host, Kirill Kobrin, editor of the Moscow-based history and sociology magazine NZ, and author of a recently published series for Open Democracy on the end of the post-Soviet period. And also joining us via Skype from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, is one of the Power Vertical's very first guests, Sean Guillory of the University of Pittsburgh Center for Russian and Eastern European Studies, author of Sean's Russia blog and host of the SRB podcast. I'd also like to remind you, you could subscribe to the Power Vertical podcast on iTunes. You could read the Power Vertical blog and watch the Daily Vertical at rferl.org. And you can follow us on the Twitter at Power Vertical.
Let's begin with Vladimir Lenin.
I think Putin has lots of reasons to be concerned.
Putin is about creating narratives.
Where are all these, you know, opposition leaders?
There is no way that Putin could hand back Crimea. Who remembers Sochi after Crimea?
Russia, you know, never be the same again.
What are we really talking about?
What are we really talking about, Sean? I don't know.
I think that was Kevin.
Was that Kevin? I think that was
that
you.
That was Kevin. No, Kevin. No, that was Kevin.
That was Kevin? Okay. All right. Well, we went anyway. I thought you're... So we've looked back, and now it's time to look ahead. I don't know if the Power Vertical podcast will make it to a 10-year anniversary. I certainly hope so, because I've had a lot of fun over the past five. But if it does, what do you imagine we'll be talking about, Mark?
Well, 5 years from now, I think it's possible that actually we'll be trying to parse Putin's recent announcement that he's going to withdraw himself from office. We'll be discussing whether he's jumped or whether he was pushed. I think that's because I don't think he's going to happen before the 2018 presidential elections, mm-hmm. and I don't think it will be happening right at the end. So that would be a suitable time thing. If we're not talking about that, though, I think we'll have just heard about the arrest of the National Guard commander and the creation of yet another security structure to watch the National Guard. Maybe the very last independent kiosk left in Russia will have been bought up by the Sechin or the Rotenbergs. I mean, in other words, if Putin is still there, I think we're actually going to get this increasing caricature of the regime that we see at the moment, because I definitely think that Putin has lost his last capacities to reinvent, his last capacities to reform, and I think he basically will ensure that, as it were, the system cannot really regenerate itself while it's there.
Well, actually, that sets me up nicely, because something I did want to raise in this, particularly in this part of the show, was Putin's very, very curious comments speaking to factory workers in Chelyabinsk this week, when he said that he didn't say he's tired, but he basically, that was the impression that he said, I would like to successfully complete my career. And God, I'd just like to travel like an ordinary Joe instead of being in this presidential bubble going from airport to hotel room and back again. What did you make of that? Because there's been some speculation out there. Tatiana Stanovaya had an interesting piece on this in Republic.ru, formerly Sloan.ru. I still have no idea why they changed their name. I like the old name. But anyway, Tatiana had a really good piece on this where she was saying it doesn't mean Putin's going to leave now, but it means he's thinking, he is thinking about leaving eventually. Maybe after the next term. And he's interested in setting the conditions that would allow him to leave peacefully and be left in to have a peaceful retirement, either in his own country or abroad. What was your read on this?
Yeah, look, I mean, again, it's often sort of hard to actually really identify what's going on. I mean, but he has seemed to be detached, bored, and unhappy.
He certainly looks so in his speech.
Exactly, and one could understand in a way that sort of from his point of view, you know, he's reached this apogee. Where does he go from here? He seems to, you know, if he hasn't, I mean, this came up very nicely in Zigar's book, the extent to which in some ways Putin was this sort of this accidental, inexorable rise rather than something that he, you know, from the beginning burned for. You know, he's got all these perks. He has either he owns it himself, or he just simply has access to, you know, so much money that you couldn't really spend in the rest of your lifetime.
You know, especially if you're 64.
Well, exactly. It depends how long he can be preserved. So I wouldn't be surprised. But this is the issue, though. I mean, you know, he's riding the tiger, maybe sort of the white Siberian tiger. That could he meaningfully actually hand over power? I think there's two things there. One is just the practical security element. You know, at what point does a subsequent regime decide that you're an enemy of the people and go after you and your money? Can you honestly just trust someone? Because this is a regime which does not trust
anybody,
except within very small circle. Well, no, I mean, you know, it's clear that there are these personal relationships, of, you know, such as the Rotenbergs and such like. But, you know, these are not people you can then make president.
No.
And secondly, just the psychological dimension. I mean, we saw this potential during the Medvedev presidency.
Yes.
When definitely sort of Putin was kind of trying out for size the idea of
moving
to a different role.
He could have done it safely and easily then.
He could, but I think this is it. But I think he pulled back, and in part, I think precisely because of vanity, of the sense that he is the indispensable figure. You know, and maybe there's a part of it that also is not wanting a successor to succeed. But, you know, but ultimately, I'm really not sure. I can see him toying with the idea. Unless something happens health-wise, psychologically, or in terms of elite politics, I think he'll continue to toy with the idea, but never quite bring himself. I think it's going to require a push to actually get him over that particular ledge.
Mm. Sean, what do you think? What will we be talking about in 5 years? And in the context of that, what did you make of Putin's comments?
Well, hopefully we won't be talking about Putin. But
you're here.
For many reasons. You know, I think what we'll be talking about over the next 5 years is how does Russia pull itself out of the situation that it's in now. I mean, because I think Kirill is right in the sense of Putin has been very good about creating dead ends. And the Donbass and Crimea are definitely dead ends on many levels, but just purely on the administrative money level. They broke it and now they've bought it and now they don't want it. At least the Donbass, and nobody wants to take it from them for a variety of reasons. Crimea is just, you know, they had a lot of glory from taking it, but now they have it. Now they have to deal with another region that needs to be, you know, massively subsidized. But the problem is that even on the economic level, the years of high growth for everyone, not just Russia, are over. the global capitalist system cannot generate itself into a high growth system anymore. It's going to be minuscule growth, if at all. It's going to be mostly stagnation across the board, and the will to create new avenues of investment will only recreate bubble situations that will pop every several years. So how does Russia, with its oil gas-dominated economy, pull itself out when all these prices are low? And even if it wanted to diversify its economy, how is it going to compete with regional places like China and others who have new, you know, large manufacturing bases? How is it going to compete on the global market and maintain a certain level of living for its labor force? So this, I think, is the big issue: is how is it going to pull this itself, or at least keep its head above water in the next 5 years in this global economic sense?
I agree with you to a point, Sean. I have a little bit more faith in the resilience of the global capitalist system. I think it's going through a very, very, very rough patch now, partially due to technology and automation, and partially due to the turbulence of globalization and adjusting to it. But I think I, for one, think it will adjust. But your point on Russia is very well taken, because how does an economy that is entirely based on hydrocarbons survive in this environment? And that I have a hard time seeing. You wanted to rebut me, I see.
Yeah, because the growth of the capitalist economy in general, if you put aside, you know, wonder moments like China and even Russia in the 2000s, they all popped at some end. It's a series of bubbles, and it's been like that for 30 years. So when is it going to revive itself in a normal sense for a long stretch of GDP growth on a global level? Right. It's just my point is, it's not that it's going to crash and burn. It's on a course of repeated bubble creation.
Yeah, and I think it'll make the necessary adjustments, just like it made the necessary adjustments.
But it hasn't in 30 years.
But 30 years is not forever. I think it made the necessary. It was going through a similar problem back in the 30s. It went at the end of the 19th century, beginning of the 20th century. In the 30s, it went through a similar problem. The West responded with the welfare state, and this worked for a time. And now we're going through another.
Keynesians hasn't worked this time. They put a look. I don't want to.
Yeah, no, we don't want to get it. We don't. But what we can agree on, is that we're in for some turbulent economic times. And yes, I would argue the more nimble economies of the West are in a better position to navigate this than the hydrocarbon heavy economy of Russia. Kirill, same question to you. What are we talking about in 5 years? And what did you make of Putin's comments in Chelyabinsk?
I'm not a specialist in dictators' psychology. I'm not Latin American novelist, you know, to know everything about this. And I'm not sure that Putin will play Leo Tolstoy and, going to some small town Astapova to die there, you know, because he's fed up with all politics and so. And Nikita Mikhalkov shooting a movie about this, you know, Tolstoy too. Speaking seriously, I think the perspective is very, you know, pessimist. I think we will speak about deterioration and decline of system of educational system, of health system, of technological system. And so I hope we'll not discuss some technological disasters and so on. But it looks like that this could happen, because all this stuff is absolutely neglected in modern Russia and so on. And I think it's time to move our attention from the very, this very figure of his psychology and his, you know, hints about his future of one person.
But a lot hinges on this.
Yes, but we must speak about, I think we have to speak more about the country, about the problems of this country and so on, because, you know, sooner or later, this guy will disappear, definitely. Mm-hmm. And something will happen. And something will happen not just on the political level, and even just social, but on the level of the infrastructure of life in this country. And that is the real problem, not who will the next leader after Putin, you know, Sechin or, you know, Alla Pugacheva or someone else. No, it's all about country, you know, and it's very dangerous. It's very dangerous because it's a huge country with a half empty, you know, depopulated, with a very old Soviet infrastructure and so on. And that is dangerous for its inhabitants and for all over, for all the world. And that's all.
No, I mean, our former colleague Paul Goebel has said on this program, on this very program, that he sees right now the very same centrifugal forces pulling at the Russian Federation that he saw pulling at the USSR in the late 80s and early 90s. Now, that you do not necessarily have to make the leap that the fates will be the same. But I have to agree with him on the centrifugal forces to a degree. I wanted to go back to this, something that's kind of underscoring all of this, everybody's comments about the problems that Russia's going to face in the next 5 years. And it's something I've been harping on the Daily Vertical, and I wrote about on my blog a little bit this past week. And that is this populist wave sweeping the world right now. Russia is not necessarily immune to this. And that it is not out of the realm of possibility that the same kind of populist revolt we've seen in the West could happen in Russia. On the day after Donald Trump's victory in the United States, Oleg Kashin had a piece in Republic.ru arguing that we have to be able to tap into this populist wave. Whether we agree with the specifics of these candidates' programs is irrelevant. We have to find a way to tap into this populist wave. Mark, is Russia immune from this, or is Russia about to get a taste of its own medicine on this?
Well, let's first of all note that Russia is not a democracy. I mean, yes. That is one of the most crucial things. So to an extent, many of the sort of structure, the thing about populism is precisely that it was actually able to exploit not just the fact that there were votes and meaningful votes and real votes, but also a media that was looking for sensation and difference and happily kind of amplifies those who kind of break the rules and say things that are different from the carefully sanitized, focus grouped sound bites of conventional so-called mainstream politicians. I can pretty much guarantee you that Pierre Vicanal would not be quite so amenable to some populist leader who kind of suddenly emerging in Moscow. So first question is actually how you break through. And there I think what we are potentially going to see, and see, I mean, if you go back to, if I can link this to what you were saying before, see, I disagree with Paul's perspective that we're actually going to see the, you know, nationalist centrifugal forces in the Russian Federation. I think actually that's one issue which outside the North Caucasus is largely addressed, even Tatarstan. But the nationalist issue is, it's the Russian nationalism, which is actually the crucial thing. It's not, I think, the centrifugal forces, but the forces from the very heart. Because we see there is a distinct sort of fraction within the Russian nationalist movement that is against the regime.
Yes.
You know, they despise the corruption.
The Sputnik and pogrom crowd.
Exactly.
Basically.
And actually, I mean, and these are people who in some ways they can tap into precisely the same veins as Navalny's or local trade union activists or whatever. They can also potentially sort of, you know, wrap themselves in a little bit of the mantle of some of the sort of, if not communism in the sense of it, the Marxist-Leninist ideology, but the kind of the ideological realities of the Soviet state, that it's about, you know, hard work and unity and such like. And I think actually that will be an interesting and problematic challenge, because, I mean, Kirill was absolutely right about the brittleness of this system. On every level. I mean, in terms of, obviously, sort of, you know, infrastructure, the economy, healthcare system. I mean, I still worry about the next pandemic that we come, which tends to sort of sweep across towards Europe from you know, across Eurasia. You know, there's all these various issues, which you never know. They're all the wild card factors, but Russia has relatively little resilience. Well, likewise, I think actually it would have relatively little resilience if someone emerged who was actually able to find a channel.
Well,
whereby they could
speak to
people, but actually was willing to do so in a much cruder way. I don't see Navalny being that.
Well, this is where I kind of wanted to go to a degree, but because another point I would make, and Mark, you make the point, this is not a democracy, and that's right. And in a democracy, there is the safety valve of elections for this populist rage to be vented. It has consequences, but as long as the institutions remain in place, we're fine in the long run. Russia, the only place to go is the streets. As you suggest, and I think you're right, this is going to come from ethnic Russians. There does seem to be one man that can channel this, and he can be crude. He can be crude too. Can Navalny be the Russian Donald Trump, the Russian Nigel Farage, the what have you?
I'm sure
not saying the content, love, yes. The content of their ideology,
yeah.
But I mean the function they played in the system.
No, because it can't happen, in my opinion, through pure political means. I mean, actually, there are two safety valves. The other valve is elite politics. But either way, I mean, this is not going to be pretty. This might involve blood, unfortunately. It certainly involves a willingness to be a lot more ruthless and a lot more brutal.
You're not sure he's got the stomach for it?
I'm not sure Navalny's got the stomach for it, but also, to be honest, Navalny is too much of a known quantity. If he starts to become problematic, then they will deal with him. I mean, one name we haven't mentioned so far, Udaltsov.
Udaltsov, who's, yeah.
You know, I mean, actually, if they just want to put someone in, you know, out of sight, out of mind. Now, okay, Navalny was more of a sort of Western darling, but nowadays the West has much less traction over what goes on in Russia. I think if it's going to be someone whom we don't expect, it's going to be the equivalent of an electrician in Gdansk who suddenly sort of emerges. I think that's almost by definition.
Mm. Sean, what do you think? This is your hobby horse.
Yeah, to use a common term throughout the year, the firewall of Russia not being a democracy, I think, is really key, because there is no outlet for this, and the outlet so far, I would argue, has been Putin. He's channeled this populism as best he can. Now the problem is, I go back to, is that, you know, before he could throw money at it. And now he can't throw money at it. So where is it going to go? And I think the Russian nationalist card is actually a potentially interesting one to think about. Because then people are asking, well, you've been telling us that we're a great power. You've been telling us that the great Russian civilization. You've been telling us all of this stuff. But look around us, as Kirill said, everything is crumbling.
Yeah.
So the question then becomes, you know, this is supposed to be for us. And it's not. And then add all of the corruption on top of that, right? Mm. So I think that a kind of nationalist populist revival, I think, is an interesting thing to think about. I don't know if it will come to fruition, but nonetheless, it's something to watch for. In terms of who's going to lead this thing, who knows? I think it's going to come out of somewhere. I agree with Mark. It's going to come from somewhere unexpected. Because I think it's going to also be a rejection across the board of all political actors that have been functioning for the last decade or so.
Mm-hmm. Kirill, last word to you. We're almost setting a record here in terms of longevity.
So I think that it's like Russia and Putin's influence on the rise of Western populism is overrated. I think the very thing populism is overrated too. It's short-lived. Even on the West. I think we will see in 2 years that all this wave will be over, definitely. Because, of course, we can speak that we live in post-truth society, you know, the most, you know,
fashion world.
Yeah. But, okay, it's post-truth society if you're speaking about, you know, migrants or something like this. But if you have to pay your bills, it's not post-truth society, it's truth. You know, the numbers on the bill.
You mean I can't tell my credit card company this is just fake news?
So when people will return to, you know, simple things like, you know, truth about numbers, about, you know, obligations and so on, all these things will be over. Definitely. And I'm not sure, I don't believe in populism and future populism in Russia, populist, you know, wide populist movement in Russia, you know, with a leader like Navalny and so on. It's just impossible, because there is no such thing as a Russia. Yes, it could be, you know, sort of populist movement in Moscow, nationalist, for instance. Yes, but have you ever heard about, you know, strong nationalist, you know, groups somewhere in Siberia? Definitely not. There were some small groups, I remember several, you know, but five, six people and so on. They're not actually people there in Siberia, in, you know, Far East and so on. They're just not interested in such things. And how could you just imagine this wide populist movement in Russia if everything is Moscow-centered and so on? So I don't believe in such, you know, course of events at all. I think the future will be, you know, quite silent. Several coups, just silent change of leaders as a head of state, but no any real sort of populist politics. Mm.
Okay, well, on that note, we will say, well, there will be no more populist politics in an age of populist politics. That's a good way to wrap it up. On that note, we'll wrap it up. That's all we have time for today. I'd like to remind you, you have been listening to a special five-year anniversary edition of the Power Vertical podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFRL. Joining me here in the studio has been co-host Mark Galliotti, a senior policy fellow at the Institute of International Relations in Prague, a visiting fellow at the European Council on Foreign Relations, and author of the blog In Moscow Shadows. And joining me on the Skype line from the Latvian town of Ventspils has been my original co-host, Kirill Kobrin, editor of the Moscow-based history and sociology magazine NZ, and author of a recently published series for Open Democracy on the end of the post-Soviet period. And also joining us via Skype from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, has been one of the Power Vertical podcast's very first guest, Sean Guillory, of the University of Pittsburgh Center for Russian and Eastern European Studies, author of Sean's Russia blog, and host of the SRB podcast. Thank you all for an enlightening, lively, interesting, fascinating, and very long discussion.
Thanks.
I'd also like to thank our brilliant, patient, and ridiculously overworked producer, Tanya Koncheva, and my indispensable and totally awesome colleague, Pavel Butorin, managing editor of RFRL's Russian language television program, Current Time, which you can watch at www.currenttime.tv. I'd also like to remind you could subscribe to the Power Vertical podcast on iTunes. You could read the Power Vertical blog and watch the Daily Vertical at rfrl.org. And you can follow us on the Twitter at Power Vertical. Join us again next week. And now, as always, I leave you with the ambient sounds of my favorite socially conscious Russian rapper, Noise MC.